This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And as you know, love letters are for anybody at any time for any reason that you have something nice to say. You can write it down, you can stamp it, you can stick it in the mail and make somebody else's life richer. And I do want to add, which I say sometimes, that taking gratitude to the grave serves no one. Why not let somebody know you're thinking something positive? You might as well share it. Today's guest is Joshua Tate, who I'm going to just go to you and let you say what you do because you'll do it better.
Sure, thanks. Well, I am a filmmaker, an independent filmmaker.
For how long?
For, I would say, I've been trying my hand at it for about 7 years. Mm-hmm. But I'm a couple years now out of film school. Got my MFA from USC, and out of there, I've been trying my hand at producing and writing and directing.
Okay, so let's hold your horses then, because let's go back.
Okay.
So talk about you as younger, and how did you get into this, and when did you know you wanted to do this, and
when
did you know you could?
You know, when I was in middle school, I would make, you know, silly videos, you know, for English class or, and, you know, just for fun. And we'd use puppets and we'd, you know, do all kinds of little things that way. And I really enjoyed editing those videos. But it wasn't really until I was in undergrad in Texas when I really...
Is that where you grew up?
That's where I grew up. Grew up in Texas, in San Antonio, and went to undergrad in Austin. And that's where the people around me started challenging me to say something more substantive with my work. You know,
how did they phrase that?
You know, it was more seeing other people doing that. And so it wasn't as much...
Oh, challenged you that way, example.
Exactly, by their example. And so I would see what they were making and seeing that it was really inspirational to me. And, you know, there would often be calls to action with what they were making.
What was important to you? Like, what calls to action?
You know, it would be calls to action involving, animal abuse, you know, human rights in general. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, I had an uncle... in Texas, who was a big disability rights advocate.
Ah, so you came to this with a certain sensibility anyway.
Exactly.
How nice.
And
yes.
So that immediately kind of, you know, framed the way I saw kind of the intersection between filmmaking, just media making in general, and kind of making a difference for
Was his
other
life
people.
Nice?
My uncle?
Yes.
It definitely had... bumps along the way.
Well, sure, but I mean, this wasn't in a time where people with disabilities were totally shunted off to some...
Well, you know, my uncle, he wasn't a self-advocate, so he himself doesn't have a disability label, but he has a daughter who has Down syndrome. Her mom and my uncle, they both were... supportive of her, and really tried to, give her as much, you know, independence and kind of community integration as they could. But there were a lot of, friends of my uncle, who didn't have that kind of support and, you know, who I got to meet along the way. A lot of people who lived in institutions in Texas.
Well, that's what I was, wondering about, because there was a time for that. Okay.
And it's still, you know, it's not over, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. You know, there are still people living in pretty restrictive environments, especially in Texas.
And is that right? Okay.
And so I made a documentary, and that was my first kind of foray into trying to make
so
something
talk about
human
that
rights.
Documentary. What is it? How did you? Who was in it? And what did you say? And
so,
where did you show it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a documentary called Forgotten Lives that I made by visiting about 5 or 6 of the 13 institutions that were in place at the time in Texas, and met several, residents of those institutions in each place, and got to really know about their hopes and their dreams and what they wanted to do.
Now, did these places treat the residents nicely? I'm asking because, like, did they welcome you with your cameras and questions?
They did. I mean, most of them did welcome me. Mm-hmm. A couple didn't, and there would be people.
And those
who
are the ones
already.
You really want to get into.
Those are the ones that we snuck in.
You know, did you?
Well, we didn't. They welcomed us, but they didn't welcome our cameras.
Of course, that's what I meant. Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, several did, and they didn't. They just didn't expect us to get the kind of interviews and, and footage that we got. And, you know, we never saw anything, you know, I never captured anything firsthand on my camera that got abuse or neglect.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But that would, you know, those stories would come out and we would talk to residents about their own experiences of abuse and neglect.
And did those residents all have living families?
Some of them did, some of them didn't.
Yeah, see, that's harsh, isn't it, if they don't?
It is, yeah. Well, and you know, if they do, sometimes that's difficult, you know, depending on, you know, whatever tension they have with their their family.
How was this documentary received? Where did you take it when you first did it?
Well, I was 19 at the time and didn't take it very far at first. It didn't go, I mean, it went to a couple of festivals that were local in Texas. And then it was a great experience, and it was received well there. Got a couple of awards, audience awards, that kind of thing. That was neat, and so that encouraged me to keep trying to make films. But you know, the biggest impact I'd say it had was my uncle took that with a nonprofit that he started called Community Now. That was all about community integration, and he would play that documentary, and it was about 45 minutes, so it wasn't quite a short, wasn't quite a feature, but he would take that around and play it at different, you know, conferences. He'd play it for different groups on college campuses in Texas and a few other states outside of Texas.
So this did get good.
It got out there.
Awareness and recognition. Is it on YouTube anywhere? Are there clips of it?
There are clips of it on YouTube.
Okay, so I'm going to do that later.
Yeah, I can send you links and stuff. But yeah, that was very early on, and I learned a lot, you know, about what I ended up feeling was the most effective way to send a message through a film.
Sure.
Because
that is the most effective way these days, and has been for a long time. Are you black and white or color?
Color. Color. Although I do appreciate a good black and white film. I'm timid about it. I don't know. I haven't found.
About using it yourself?
About using it myself.
The reason I ask you is this. There was a question once that I was asked for some test, and I can't tell you how I feel about even having to take tests. But anyway, here was the question. If you had a point to make and you were going to make a movie to make that point, would you do it in black and white or color? Pick a side. And it was, I thought, a really interesting question, this was years ago, which is why I'm throwing it to you.
That's a fascinating question because...
Yes.
Because I think, you know, it would be tempting for me to say black and white.
Why?
To make a cut and dry statement.
Because it looks like authentic fact, and it looks like, it looks like that,
like the printed word, or something.
When it's in black and white, it looks more authentic as far as information, like a newsreel.
Yeah, absolutely.
It has that and color.
Color
can come off as, because I see people say, "Oh, that's not really a biography; it's a movie." Now, not that you can't learn from it, but people don't take it as seriously, and yet more people will watch it. What do you do?
That's really interesting. Right. I mean,
I failed this test because I couldn't pick a side. Yeah. By the way,
you were going back and forth.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I say, you know, it's tempting for me to go black and white, but perhaps I would go on the color side. Mm-hmm. I mean, because
more people watch it.
Because more people would watch it. And also,
a little bit of color makes the medicine go down.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Well, and also I wonder if showing, you know, presenting characters, you know, subjects, real people who are going, you know, who are living real lives and bringing up complex questions without giving clear-cut answers. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that is more effective in terms of letting the medicine go down, like letting it sit with people and letting them decide on their own. You can't, I mean, you have to, you know, I would slant a certain direction, obviously, but instead of trying to do a clear-cut black and white answer and saying, you know, this is what you need to believe.
Yes.
Want to present something complex and really, you know, give an audience the benefit of the doubt in terms of, you know.
So you don't take. You don't do fiction.
I do fiction actually.
Now.
And in fact, Forgotten Lives, that documentary I did was the first and only documentary I've ever made.
Oh, okay. So go ahead, continue.
So that. You know, after doing that, I started to think that at least for me, it would be more effective for me to make fiction, you know, perhaps based on real people.
Oh, but, I like those. Yeah.
But either way, I mean, even if it's a fictional character, working with real people to make sure that the story, it feels as authentic as possible.
When you see a movie and you think you're going to really learn something, like Stephen Hawking or The Butler, and then you find out later that it's really very not close to true, and, you know, do you feel at all like you've been cheated?
I do. I do
feel...
I like
feel... the things say very loosely based on, and then I know where it's... Yeah.
And that's a tough call, because I want to believe that it is in some way, you know, thematically, spiritually true, right?
Well, that's another issue. You can do that in any, yes.
But in that case, if you're going to do something like that, why even try to give the illusion that it's all based on fact and all?
This is interesting. So the filmmakers have a lot of things to consider. It's not a diving right in kind of a thing.
I believe so, yeah.
So what are the fiction things that you're working on?
So the first feature that I made, the first fiction feature that I made was called Loveland.
Loveland.
Mm-hmm. And that was about a young woman who had a traumatic brain injury, who was placed in an institution in Texas. So you can see the relation with the first documentary I did. And she fights to get out of there by manipulating a couple of residents who are there. She sees herself as better than those.
Is that something that we'd have seen in theaters? And
it hasn't had a release in theaters. It has been to several film festivals. We premiered at the New Orleans Film Festival last year, and got an audience award and some recognition there. And then played at a few others. Cleveland. It'll be playing in St. Louis. Mm-hmm.
Will you be able to get that on Netflix?
We hope so.
Is that something you have to do to get something on Netflix? I don't even know how that works.
It's something where, I mean, you work with a sales rep and then hopefully get a distributor of some sort. There are distributors of all different shapes and sizes. And so, you know, working with a distributor that could help you get, you know, digital distribution. So iTunes, Netflix, video on demand with some cable networks.
So you don't just call up Netflix and say, I'd like to send you this.
I mean,
Apparently not.
Some people do, but I don't know if I have the clout to do it at this point.
Yeah, okay.
With Netflix, at least. So,
I'm wondering about that. So it takes clout? I mean, you have an enormous amount of charm. What if you just called and tried it?
Well, I appreciate that. I think maybe I'm
They're very
just
nice
too
when they answer
to
the phone.
Well, maybe I should try.
Have you ever called Netflix? I know I'm way off track here, but I am everybody's mommy, and I do have something to say here about that. I have called on a couple of occasions because something's gone wrong, and they answer the phone, and they are so nice, and they're smart. Hmm. I'm wondering if you called them. I'm wondering if I called them. Okay, I've got a lot to do, but so do you. I'm wondering if you called them and talked to one of these people and said, can you connect me with somebody who, I'm just curious what you'd get.
Maybe I should try.
You should.
You know, I mean, just, you know, stand up for the work.
Why not?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, that's, by the way, that's the old conundrum of the prettiest girl in the class doesn't get a prom date because everybody thinks she's already been asked and won't take the chance for the rejection. And there she sits at home alone.
Well, that's certainly a flattering thought. That would be
okay.
But I do. I mean, I do want to get it out there, mm-hmm. you know, digitally, at least on iTunes. You know, we'll finish our festival run in November and then hope to get it out there.
Okay. And was that the last thing you worked on? So you're ready to start something new?
That's right. I'm ready to start something new. It was the last feature that I worked on. Mm-hmm. And so after that I wrote and directed a short film starring Lauren Potter from Glee called Guest Room.
And how did you get her?
I think Loveland was, helped me with that.
Did you just call her?
I called up her agent, mm-hmm. called up her agent. Found her information on IMDb Pro mm-hmm. and just called her up and sent the script. And I lucked out and they enjoyed the script and got to have a meeting and it all kind of went from there. And so, I showed them.
Where do you do this? Where do you make these? I have some questions about how do you make a movie?
Sure.
Where do you do this?
Well,
you rent studio space?
Sometimes, I mean, a lot of people I know do that. For me, when I'm writing something that I know is going to be low budget, I start with the locations that I know I have access to pretty inexpensively, because that can often add up, especially in LA, where everybody kind of puts a price tag
right.
on any
anything.
Location.
Everything is real estate. Yeah,
absolutely. And right. so I started with my apartment.
Good.
I knew I could
yeah.
shoot there.
Yeah.
I knew I had family, friends, who lived up in Anyway. Anyway, so I knew that. I knew I had access to certain locations,
uh-huh.
and I backed into that and wrote, a script based on that I thought Lauren Potter would fit really well, in terms of the main character. Mm-hmm. I had, she has a boyfriend in the movie, and I had that actor in mind already. I'd worked with him before on Loveland, and
You do all the camera work?
I don't do the camera work. I have. I was fortunate to meet a lot of really great DPs in film school who do that job way better than me, and so I'm always happy to give that work to them. And
so film school provided you with a lot.
Absolutely,
uh-huh.
absolutely. It provided me with some debt, but it also gave me so much in terms of network, that the people who I got to meet, who I work with.
Okay,
still.
So that kind of answers questions. You're not jumping into this from a vacuum.
Absolutely
okay.
not. Absolutely not. I have a lot of people I rely on.
Now tell me about your family.
I am very close to my family. We go on a lot of vacations together, maybe too many.
They live in Texas still?
They live in Texas now. Mm-hmm. They actually lived in the Bay Area for a few years.
But where were you born?
I was born in Vallejo, California.
Oh, because you have no Texas accent and you sound totally California. I'm like, okay.
Well, I was born there, although I moved to Texas when I was five.
But
and
you were
raised
by people who weren't raised in Texas.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Although,
I was wondering about that.
My mom is a Southern Belle. She's from Gulfport, Mississippi.
Oh.
But my dad was a Navy brat.
Uh-huh.
And so he doesn't have an accent either.
Yes.
He
okay.
probably spent more time in Pennsylvania and New Jersey than anywhere else. Yeah.
I'm always curious about that. All right. So I wondered about that, that you're close with them. So they're behind you 100% what you do. And
they are. I mean, I remember, I wasn't always sure that I wanted to be a filmmaker. I know that I enjoyed doing it.
What were the other things you thought about?
I thought about psychology.
Oh, yes.
And I thought about law school. My dad's a lawyer,
uh-huh.
and I was always really interested in what
he was doing. Well, psychology is huge in filmmaking. I mean, that's all what you're talking about in the movies that you're making.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's amazing how much it links up. And I also, make sure that it links up because it interests me so much. And so I started out majoring in psychology in undergrad and then ended up tacking on film.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, filling out, I took, all the, the LSAT, and I took, is it the GRE?
By the way, that's where this question about if you were to do a movie in black and white was.
Uh-huh.
I was on. It was an LSAT question.
Really?
Yes. An essay.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But yeah, no, that actually fits in really interesting.
Sure, because you make an argument for one side or the other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So anyway, go ahead.
So yeah, so I had taken, I had taken the LSAT, I had taken the GRE. I remember looking at applications for psychology grad school and for law school and for film grad school, and my parents were the ones who actually encouraged me to do film. And, their argument being that this is, probably the best time to give it a shot.
Yes.
Didn't have a family or,
yes.
That was the time to try it.
And so just the part of you, the genetic gift of law talent is the way you just said that.
How so?
That, I forget what you said already, but it was kind of like, all things being equal, it was getting from point A to point B logically and figuring something out.
That
quality can't hurt you either.
Well, it certainly helps with producing.
Yes.
And I think, and in some ways, writing and directing. I mean, a script, in some ways, is an equation that you want to show to people as if it's not an equation, and mask that over with the art of it. But it is pretty interesting how logic and that whole
yes.
kind of critical thinking.
Because when you don't see that in the movie, you don't see every frame leading to something.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you fall asleep.
It's true.
I think.
I think so too. I think every scene needs to build to the other.
Yeah. Do you have favorite movies?
I definitely do.
Can you say what a couple are? I'm just curious.
Sure. I mean, one of my they're pretty different from each other, but yeah. One of my favorites is There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson. You know, to me, it's...
What makes it a favorite?
There's something about the world and the tone that just completely, sucks me in and doesn't let go. Hmm. It feels like a dark comedy to me. I've heard P.T. Anderson refer to it as a horror film, which I could see too. But it's something where I've just never quite seen a movie like it. With just, the beautiful cinematography, but, performances that feel so real, but also so over the top at the same time. Yeah, it's just a really fun film to watch for me.
I'm always interested in what people are wired for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is such a thing.
Sure.
You know, certain things just reach you and yes.
Say that I also love Short Term 12.
I don't know if that is.
So that's an indie film that went to South by Southwest a couple years ago and won, got the jury prize and the audience award and had a limited theatrical release. But it is very different from There Will Be Blood. It takes place in a not a foster home, but a shelter for at-risk teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about this counselor at that shelter who, learns that she's pregnant and she's wondering about, does it make sense to bring another child into the world when she's surrounded by all of these, all of these teenagers who, really, it doesn't make a good case for a happy world. Anyway, so it's a very sweet film, actually, that's like, it couldn't be more different from There Will Be Blood, but really, enjoy the way that it's directed and written and everything. It's such a simple film, but so beautiful.
And the challenges these days are technical and legal and I don't know what the word is, but how you get things out. I see movies. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm an old woman, and so it's changed. But there used to be a movie, and you'd have the credits, which were limited, and it was called the players, see? And you'd have some actors, and it didn't matter who did the catering and who held the insurance. I mean, the credits were short. Critical, but short. And then you had the title and the movie. And today it's a such and such film. It's presented by and distributed by. And there are about 8 different companies that seem to get involved in getting a movie out there.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, I think
it's overwhelming.
It's very overwhelming. And a lot of it has to do with dividing up the risk, the financial risk getting a movie made. So oftentimes when you see that many companies, it means that they all, paid, a smaller share,
So I never even thought of that kind of thing because you see things like, I think it's called a working title film and there's several names and they seem to do different things.
Yeah. I mean, I think.
And distribution is totally separate.
Absolutely. I mean, especially with independent films.
You know, even mainstream films, they call another company to get it out there.
That's true. And you see a lot of big production companies that have, overhead deals at studios and they have offices, on the studio lots. And so they, it's a first look deal where that distributor, that big studio, will have the first chance to actually present it and distribute it out.
When things go from being just a straight art or small offering to an industry, of course, that's a big difference.
Absolutely.
So if you were to write a love letter right now, do you write letters?
I don't write letters by hand. I have in the past, but not on a regular basis.
I like that you say regular basis because sometimes people think of when we talk, would you write a love letter to? And it is a way of life. It is kind of a regular basis thing.
I think so. I think it's a dialogue. It becomes most beautiful when it's a dialogue, and that means going back and forth.
It also means, though, when you send a letter to somebody, you're not obligated, you other person, to answer immediately. And today's communication, by the way, if you send an email to somebody, or you get an email and you don't answer it within 30 seconds, You get one 2 hours later saying, well, I emailed you. How come you didn't answer me? And I want to say, human beings get to spend more than 2 hours before they have to come up with a response.
It's true.
You would think.
And with text messages, oftentimes you have, read receipts. So you know when somebody's read.
Yes.
And so there's that added pressure of answering immediately.
Pressure. Because that's the word. Yes.
Because that time between, that is analyzed. Every second becomes its own kind
Although
of message.
Although texting's a whole other thing that you really do
it's
need.
Not a letter necessarily.
Right. And I heard recently, which just floored me, although I understand it, that it's now considered rude to make a phone call.
Oh.
I like that.
Huh.
Because, first of all, you're always interrupting somebody. They're always doing something.
True.
And it's a kind of a waste of time in many cases because if they're, you get the answering machine and you go back and forth. But who would you write a love letter to? And a love letter being any gratitude or invitation into your life or anything at all. A memory.
Wow.
I'm hoping I get to send you home with a piece of homework.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you are a writer after all.
This is true in theory, yeah.
And, this part always fascinates me because I look down the line 50 years and you are taking part in an industry that has kind of an important history when people look back.
Mm.
I mean, everything is in a way.
Sure.
But you are in an industry that is communicating with, when you're lucky, 4 billion people at a clop.
Mm.
That's being a big part of civilization.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice for somebody to be able to look back and see a couple of letters from you that kind of document your early time on Earth?
It's true. I mean, I actually think back, to recently I was visiting my parents and I saw my mom took out a collection of letters from my great grandparents.
Of course.
And it was incredible. And it's just, I can't see it being the same with email.
It isn't.
Looking through
it isn't.
Your ancestors' email.
You know why? Because handwriting is king.
It's true.
Because handwriting is like the fingerprint of the heart.
Mm.
No, everybody's got Lucida Bright.
Mm, sure.
Nobody's got your handwriting.
Yeah.
And your handwriting will reflect a lot that you're, and letters that have a little, tea spill or tears or a lipstick. And when
Even
they
better.
Touch that letter in 50 years, they're going to be holding something that's felt the touch of your hand.
Sure.
I mean, email's wonderful. I'm addicted myself. So I understand. But if you get lovely emails, I think you should print them out on good paper, laser, so it lasts.
Yeah.
But anyway, so those love letters that you saw were compelling, right?
They were.
And absolutely. Do you know how old are they now, 100 years?
I mean, close to it. I'd say, 1920, so almost 100 years.
Right. And it turns out, I have realized recently, that a letter is still the best information storage device around.
Mm.
Because those letters will look like they're new for another 200 years, maybe longer. I mean, I have letters that are like 200 years old, and they look like they were written yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I have floppy disks that I have flushed down the toilet because whatever's on those, I don't have.
Right.
Technology changes.
And those media storage devices always, they degrade over
That's right.
a very oh, short amount of time. Even hard
drives. Your VCRs.
And, oh, that too.
Those corrode, and you get a lot of gurgle and smack.
Right.
And it doesn't even matter because you can't, even if they work, and your player goes out, you can't get another one. You throw yourself on the mercy of eBay. But, your days are numbered.
Yeah.
So did you read some of those letters?
I did.
And?
I did. I read one that really touched me was a letter from my great great grandfather to my great grandmother.
Wow!
When she had
that's more than 100 years.
It was I think it was in
or it's these that you're talking about.
It's I think it was because she was in college at the time.
I see. Okay. Well.
And so it would have been more than 100 years. It would have been maybe in the 19.
And there you have it.
Turn of the century. But it was really neat because he was just telling her to, focus on her studies and really focus on, being independent and having a career and not focusing on boys. And it was just saying how much she meant to him and everything. And it was neat. You can see kind of the influence of, maybe not that letter alone, but you know, just the influence of that message and that attitude to what I knew was my great grandmother's career.
Okay, so then I want to say to you, doesn't that, you're smiling. I mean, this is when I need a television moment because I want people to see the grin on your face. And because doesn't that feel like a wonderful legacy that you come from that now you know about that?
It does.
Yes.
It does.
Yes. That gives you clout. I think. Yes.
I mean, yeah, just having
And that was
knowledge.
Unusual for the time when a lot of girls were being told to go to college to get their MRS degree.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what was your grandmother's career?
She was a musician. So she taught music, but she was also, she wrote symphonies and she was a piano performer.
And you never knew her?
I met her when I was very young and didn't really... And I don't really remember it.
Oh, I see a love letter to her.
Oh, from her father?
No, from you.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Oh. Can you take that as your assignment?
I can.
And do a love letter to her. I've just been thinking about you because I saw the... What did you call her?
I was so young.
What would you call her now?
What would I call her?
Oof. Grandma?
Probably grandma.
Okay, so whatever you would decide to call her.
Yeah.
I just happened to see a letter, yada-da-da-da-da-da, and I just wanted to let you know what this means to me and what I see in you and what I know has come down to me through my, whatever it is. You're a writer, as I said. And mail it to, okay, I'm writing this to you, but I'm going to mail it to my parents.
Okay.
And mail it to your parents.
Okay.
And keep a copy.
I like that.
Oh, those are so much fun. You get to bathe in such positive of your own genetic good luck.
Huh. I love that idea. And she was a writer as well. I saw a story, a short story that she wrote.
So you can refer to all these things.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
What did that mean to you? And how nice that generations and death have not separated you.
Mm. Yeah.
That's thank lovely. You for doing this with me.
Oh, thank you so much for having
me.
This has been
lovely.
I
had such a good time with you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Likewise.
So until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye. And I just want to say, as always, that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion. And it is your own history documented in your own hand and not so different from any documentary in some regards that you might consider making, Joshua.
Hmm.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you.
Bye.